Thank you, Will. Thanks for the invitation to give this talk. So as you can see, this is going to be a talk about the physics of compact objects in general relativity. Our goal is to study the astrophysics of single and binary systems. And when we say here compact objects, this is synonymous to the strong gravity regime. So the systems that we want to analyze are rotating stars like magnetars, proton, neutron stars, quark stars, and so on, binaries of every kind, binary black holes, binary neutron stars, or post-merger objects like black hole with a disk around them, and so on. There is a plethora of topics in physics that are involved. First and foremost is the general theory of relativity. And at the same time, we have fluid dynamics, electrodynamics, and so on. And also in mathematics, geometric analysis, numerical analysis, and others. So this is a very rich topic. That's why we're so much happy to study it. So my talk is going to have three parts. On the first part, I'm going to motivate the problem, and I'm going to try to explain the initial value problem in general relativity. In the second part, I'm going to describe briefly the code that we have developed to solve that problem. And in the third part, I'm going to focus on the astrophysics applications like black hole disks, binary neutron stars, and others. The first half of my talk is going to be devoted in parts one and part two. The last half is going to be part three. So let's start with the initial value problem in general relativity. So, of course, the starting point is the Einstein's theory, is the Einstein's equations, as you can see them here. There is the following issue. With the exception of a few idealized problems where one has exact solutions, one has to resort to numerical solutions in order to describe a realistic physical system. Of course, all of them are described by the same Einstein equations, but every system requires its own assumptions and needs different techniques for its solution. So the question is, when you have two different systems, like the ones that you can see on the right and the left pictures, like a binary neutron star or a rotating neutron star with magnetic fields, what are the essential ingredients that describe this system? So in trying to address the different techniques question, we have to answer two questions. I'm showing here two different systems, like a binary neutron star and a black hole with a disk around it. So the questions that we need to answer is, what are the quantities that describe this relativistic physical system at a given moment? This is very important if we want to do evolutions of these systems. And second, how do we compute them? The answer to the first question in Newtonian mechanics, we all know force equals mass times acceleration. So one has to give some position and some velocities initially, and he will be able to integrate that equation and move forward. So essentially the initial conditions are somehow are related to some kind of primitive variables, so they are trivial to be assigned. Is this the case for general relativity? And if it is not, what are we doing? In order to answer that question, we have to think what general relativity is asking for. And the solution in general relativity is a four-dimensional manifold. So we need a prescription of the metric of the four-dimensional metric. Now, one way to envision that is to think that this the whole four-dimensional metric is decomposed of three-dimensional volumes that are moving in time along a time vector, as you can see here. I hope you can see my, by the way, I want to ask if you can see my pointer.
Yeah, we can see it.
Okay, that's good. So these three-dimensional volumes here are depicted as two-dimensional surfaces. That's why we call them hypersurfaces. And then we can introduce some functions like the lapse function that shows how time is evolving as we go from one hypersurface to another, and the shift vector that shows how the spatial coordinates evolve. within the hypersurface, and also the metric gamma ij that measures distances within this hypersurface. And then by using the Lorentzian analog of the Pythagorean theorem in the red triangle, one can write the space-time metric in this general form. There are some other quantities that are called k alpha beta here, which I'm going to talk about them a little bit in the following minutes. But at the end of the day, the Einstein equations can be written as this first order dynamical system with respect to the gamma ijs and the kijs. The right hand side depends on the gamma ijs, the kijs, and the new functions that we have introduced, the alpha and the beta. And it is subject also, all these functions are subject to four constrained equations. The first one is the F constrained equations, and then the GI3 constrained equations there. So for the people who are not expert, in order to understand this a little bit better, I'm going to do a small historical digression. And I'm going to go back into the 18th century and ask the same question: how does one identify a one-dimensional manifold, which is a three-dimensional curve? In order to do that, one has to build the Frenet triedron on each point of the curve, which is composed of three vectors, the tangent, the normal, and the binormal, and take derivatives of that triedron and write down this dynamical system with respect to these three vectors. On the right-hand side of this dynamical system, there are two functions that appear, which is called the curvature kappa and the torsion tau, as you can see here. There are only those two functions. And then we have the fundamental theorem of curves that says that if two curves can be written with the same dynamical system, which means that they have the same curvature and torsion, then these two curves differ by an isometry, which means that you can translate and rotate one curve and put it exactly on top of another. In this way, we have an intrinsic way of characterizing these one-dimensional curves, which is what we want to do in our general relativistic problem. On the 18th century example is the identification of a two surface. This is an example which is very close to our general relativistic problem, and that's why I'm mentioning it here, because it's much easier to understand and grasp. So similarly, at every point, every surface, as we know, can be parameterized by two variables, u and v, and the surface is this x of u and v function. So on every point on that surface, we can construct again a triedron by the two tangent vectors, the xu and xv and the normal vector. And then similarly to what we have done in the one-dimensional case, take derivatives of that triedron. Then you have the second derivatives of x and the first derivatives of n. And you see that the kij symbols appear here are related to the normal derivatives of the derivatives of the normal vector, which essentially decode the curvature of the normal sections of this curve. So if you imagine a plane like the blue plane that I have drawn here intersecting the surface, the intersection is a curve, the curvature of that curve is encoded into the symbols kij. Now, this is an overdetermined system, but fortunately, there are the constraint equations that are coming from the equality of the mixed derivatives, higher order mixed derivatives, which are nothing less than the Gauss and the Meynardi-Kodaty equations. And then we have the Bonnet theorem that says that if you give the gamma ijs and the kijs of the surface, which is the first and the second fundamental form of this surface, such as that they satisfy these constraint equations, then any other surface differs by an isometry. Now, one can make a leap of imagination and go on to the 20th century and imagine that our four-dimensional space-time manifold is foliated by these three-dimensional surfaces or hypersurfaces. So if we give, again, the gamma ijs and the kijs at a given moment, then we identify the manifold up to an isometry. There is a long history of research that has been done in the subject, and let me tell you that this is not as obvious as I have depicted it, the embedding theorems, in especially in mathematics, with the famous theorems of Nash and Whitney, are a very big subject. But for us, the grandfather in the initial value problem is Georges Darmois, that he was the first guy who understood that problem back in 1929. So, having said that, I'm going to go back into our two questions that I asked. What are the basic ingredients that characterize two seemingly totally different systems? And these are the gamma ijs and the kjs, which are essentially the geometry and the velocity of the geometry, the analog of the position and the velocity of Newtonian mechanics. Well, the problem is that these two quantities don't look like primitive variables, so how do we compute them? So the way to compute it is we go back into the Einstein system and we make some reasonable assumptions regarding the time derivatives of the geometry and its velocity, and that results into an elliptic set of equations that we can solve. Of course, this is not trivial to do. One fruitful idea has been introduced back in 1944 by Andrei Liknevovich, which says that instead of solving for the physical three metric, the gamma ijs, make a conformal transformation and try to solve for the conformal geometry first. The reason that this is technically appealing is that the F equation, the third equation in this list, gives a nice elliptic equation for the conformal factor, and then somehow one can try to work the whole system and try to compute one by one all the variables. So there is substantial work that has been done over the past 40 years in this subject, and to solve the initial value problem for every possible configuration, from rotating neutron stars, black holes, and so on, and the code that I'm going to talk in a little bit is addressing all these systems. So are we done? Well, certainly we are done with the Einstein equations, but let's not forget that we have also other kind of fields. We have the Euler equations, we have the Maxwell equations, and so on, and let's not forget that all the sources from these equations are getting into the stress energy tensor of the Einstein equation, so they are coupled in this way, so the question is, do we solve the above system self-consistently and solve all the equations simultaneously, or do we solve part of it self-consistently and some of the equation we assume some ad hoc values? Well, the answer to that question depends on the problem and what we can do. Essentially, we try to expand our mathematical methods in order to be as self-consistent as possible. But the takeaway message is that the self-consistent solution of the full set of equations presents a daunting challenge. I'm moving on the second part, which is the code that we have developed, which is called Compact Object Calculator. So this code has been developed over the past like 10 years, and it has different kind of modules. Every line represents a different module. In the first line, you can see the module that solves rotating neutron stars or rotating quark stars in axisymmetric or a triaxial configuration with uniform rotation or differential rotation. The gravity, again, depends on the problem. We either use some approximation like the Eisenberg-Wilson-Matthews approximation, or we solve the full gravity sector, and similarly for the electromagnetic fields. And then there are other modules that have to do with binary black holes, binary neutron stars, and black hole toroids. And we continue to work in this code and to put more physics into the problems. So how do we solve the elliptic equations? Well, we write all the field equations in a form like a non-linear Poisson system. As you can see here on the top, and we use the representation formula for the partial differential equations to invert for those functions. Now, this method, who has its roots in the works of Ostreicher and Bonazzola, have been pioneered by Komatsu, Eriguchi, and Hasitsu, and typically is in the community is called the KEH method. Of course, when you have multiple compact objects like a binary, there are issues that have to do with the volume, the boundary of the volume, and the Green's functions that you are going to use. We don't have a formal proof why this method works. We only have some empirical experience when it works and when it doesn't. And the first numerical implementation of this has been done back in 2007 for binary black holes. I'm going to quickly show you how we do it for a binary, let's say, black hole neutron star system. So what do we have is for a binary system, we have typically three coordinate systems. The two of them, the blue and the red, are centered on the center of each compact object. And there is a third one, which is centered on the center of mass of the system and extends to the asymptotics. We solve all the equations in all coordinate systems. So for example, if we have 10 elliptic equations, we solve them on every coordinate system. And hopefully if the iterations goes well and convergence appears, then we have a smooth solution everywhere. I can explain more about the code maybe later, since time is limited. I want to move into the third part, which is our main goal, which is the astrophysics of the compact objects. And as a first problem, I'm going to start with self-gravitating and tilted black hole disks. This is a problem that we started recently, and it has two parts. The first is to construct those initial data of self-gravitating tilted black hole disks, and second, to evolve the systems and understand their dynamics. So recently we have been able to solve the full Einstein system. And when I'm saying full Einstein system, I'm referring to that we not only solve for the laps, the conformal factor, and the shift that it is typically done for initial data calculations, but also for the conformal geometry by using a new technique, which employs also horizon penetrating coordinates. And we have been able to achieve high spin and tilted black holes. In order to construct disks, we start with a seed, a very small mass disk, which is either a Fishbone Moncrief or an Abramovich Zavozinski Sikora disk. You can see on the right plot the specific angular momentum and the potential, and with two vertical lines, I'm referring to the cusp and the center of the disk. The cusp is this red intersection here, and the center is the center of these isocontours here on the left, and the disk can fill any of these closed equipotentials. And by essentially pumping up the density, we can construct sequences of more massive disks. Such a massive disk can be seen here. This disk is five times the mass of the black hole. We have computed the apparent horizon, irreducible mass, and angular momentum of the black holes, and tried to estimate the black hole mass from the Christodoulou formula. I found that the spin of the black hole is almost maximal, and it has a 30 degrees by construction. It has a 30 degrees tilt with respect to the angular momentum of the disk. The conformal factor of the geometry, you can see it on the right plot with blue and red solid lines, is the conformal factor along the X and the Y axis, and with dashed lines are the original Kerr-Shield conformal factor. So as I said, we are interested in evolving all these self-gravitating disks. Well, I'm hearing some echo right now. I don't know where it's coming from, but well, that's better. okay, thank you. So here on the bottom, I have two disks on an initial stage on the left, and at a later stage on the right. So I'm going to play the movie as I'm explaining what we are trying to do here. In particular, we want to analyze the instabilities that arrive in black hole disk systems. And one such instability is the Papaluizu Pringle instability, Orange showed the PPI. This is a non-axisymmetric instability. It is driven by interactions from the inner and outer boundary of the torus, and linear analysis shows that there are two unstable modes, one growing and one decaying. this kind of instability depends on the angular momentum of the distribution of the disk. And the original discovery has been done with constant angular momentum profiles. This the movie that you are seeing is for a non-constant angular momentum profile. And actually, in collaboration with the Arizona group, we are trying to understand this phenomenon better. And Eric Vessel actually presented his APS talk on that subject, although the simulation that you see here is from our own work. that is for the disks for the moment. As a second problem, it has to do...
Sorry to just interrupt, but just before you go on.
Yeah.
So I got a little bit lost regarding like what sort of assumptions went into constructing these disks. Like, I mean, presumably there's some things you try to specify about the disk, and then you're solving these equations for the geometry and so forth.
Yes.
So could you say a little bit more about that?
The main assumption is the angular momentum distribution. So how, in order to solve the Euler equations, you have to assume a differential rotation law. And that differential rotation law is the main player in the Papaluizu-Pringle instability. Of course, the things that we don't know is what happens when these disks are self-gravitating and when we have spins, and also when we have tilted spins. So this is our focus, the focus of our future investigations.
And so what did you assume for like the distribution of angular momentum in the disk, or you just tried different things?
That's right. So we start, for example, with constant angular momentum, and then we have, if I want to explain a little bit of more details, when the angular momentum goes like R to some power, that power is crucial to if you are going to have the PPI instability or not. For certain values of that power, you have it, but for others, you don't. And there is a question of what happens when the disk becomes heavier, and also what happens when you have spin.
Can I ask a question, Antonio? So when you solve for the black hole, so the conformal metric, is this conformally to what, flat or Kerr-Scheele or?
So that's what I'm saying. This is this is back to this paper that I'm writing up down. So we don't assume anything. We solve for gamma tilde ij. So we solve both for the lapse, both for the shift, the conformal factor, and the conformal geometry. So the system of elliptic equations together with the gauge conditions is 17. So this is a 17 by 17 elliptic system.
And how do you know that the problem is well posed that way?
We don't.
I see.
We don't. Okay. We are interested into investigating this issue. We don't. But what we can do is try to, for example, have a tilted black hole, pure black hole, and try to reproduce that solution. And we were able to do that and get convergence. And then we, of course, put the matter around it and so on and so on. So yes, you are right. We don't know this deeper question, but for the moment, this is what we can do.
Yeah, thank you.
For the second problem that I want to present, this is an older work, but it's somehow like a perennial issue, the Newton-Stern maximum mass. And this has to do with the event GW170817. So the Newton-Stern maximum mass, when we say maximum mass, we are referring to the maximum mass of a spherical Newton star. And this is a very important number because it characterizes the equation of state, which is an unknown thing in modern astrophysics for the supranuclear densities that that appear inside the neutron star. So there are three important numbers here that you can see on the y-axis, which is the M max spherical, which, as I said, is the maximum TOV limit. The maximum, the M max sup, which is the maximum supermassive limit. This is the maximum mass of uniformly rotating stars. And for most equations of state, as you can see here, is approximately 1.2 times the maximum spherical mass. And then there is the green curve, which I'm going to call it the prompt collapsed curve. So you can imagine when you have two binaries, when you have a binary and the two stars are merging, they produce a remnant. Now, if this remnant is very heavy, it immediately collapses into a black hole. This means that the mass is above this of this green curve. The other scenario is that it stays there for a little bit before it collapses, which means that it is below the green curve. So this green curve essentially distinguishes between prompt collapse or not. And approximately this is 1.4 or there is a discrepancy in that factor of the maximum spherical mass. And depends of course on the equation of state. Now, if we want to go a little bit further, Hartle, back in 1978, has done the following experiment. He has taken the equation of state, removed the inner core of that equation of state, and replaced it with the maximum stiffness equation of state. And he found that the maximum spherical limit depends on the matching density epsilon m according to this formula. Now, the Milwaukee group has repeated that experiment with rotating stars, and they have found a similar formula down here for the maximum supermassive limit, which means that if you combine these two formulas, you find out that the maximum supermassive limit is approximately 1.27, the maximum spherical limit, instead of 1.2 for regular equations of state. Now, why I'm saying all of these things, and why we are interested in all those things, is because we are trying to explain the short gamma ray bursts that appeared in event ZW17-0817. So we have done some simulations with magnetic fields, and every column represents a different class according to the mass. The first column is the supermassive, the second is the light hypermassive, and the third one is the heavy hypermassive. So let me start from the third column, which is the heavy hypermassive, and I'm going back here, and I'm saying heavy hypermassive means that we are above the green curve here. So above the prompt collapse curve. So when the two stars merge, they immediately form a black hole and we see no sign of a jet. So this kind of scenario for multiple kinds of cases that we have investigated, we disfavor this kind of a scenario. The second, the middle column, which is the the light hypermassive, it corresponds to the Haast region here, which is our scenario. It's between the M max sup and the M threshold. And as you can see, when you have the two stars that are merging, they form a differentially rotating heated object, which is going to redistribute its angular momentum through gravitational radiation, magnetic winding, turbulence, and so on, and what you are going to have a post-merger object which is going to stay there for a little bit of time before it collapses to a black hole. In the meantime, what we can see is that we can have an outflow, as you can see from the middle panel, and from the lower panel, you can see that we can also achieve high values of the magnetic fields around the black hole, and this is what we called as an incipient bona fide jet. Similarly, for the supermassive case, you have the supermassive case. Let me remind to you that it is the case that corresponds between the M max spherical and the M max sup. So it's between these two, the blue and the dashed red line. So here you have a remnant neutron star which is rotating. You have a collimated magnetic field, but unfortunately you don't have neither the outflow nor the strong magnetic field around the neutron star in order to say that you have a bona fide jet. Of course, there are a lot of things to be said here, but just from this naive picture that I'm saying, you can set some interesting limits. In particular, you can take the value from event GW170817, the 2.74 masses, and say that that should be between the threshold mass and the maximum supermassive mass, which are both related to the maximum spherical mass by the factors alpha and beta. and you can solve for the maximum spherical mass. If you observe the right inequality, this should be smaller than 2.74 divided by beta. And the beta is, as we have said, either 1.2 or 1.3. And you find an upper limit, which is between 2.2 and 2.3, approximately. Of course, there are a lot of caveats in this kind of analysis, and it's by no means this should be maybe the final picture, but this is our current understanding as far as this subject.
Can I ask you a question on that?
Yes.
Yeah, so on the supermassive case, you said you don't have strong fields, but I mean, does your simulation capture the potential growth? All the potential instabilities on the electromagnetic sector that would have completely changed, that could completely change the picture. Are you sufficiently?
You are absolutely right in the sense that, of course, we cannot be sure that we are capturing this kind of instabilities. And this is just a couple of simulations that this group in here has performed. What we have seen is that you can see that there is a collimation of the magnetic field, but unfortunately this simulation have gone up to 200 milliseconds. This is a very long simulation, but we haven't seen the growth of the magnetic field. As you can see, the color bar here shows the magnetic field. In the middle pictures, you see that the magnetic field is like this purple color, which goes like 200. B squared over 8 pi rho goes to 200. Well, in this case, it doesn't. So although, as I agree with what you said, this is by no means a full picture, we can see some two differences. And from these two scenarios, we can definitely say that the middle case is favored than the left case.
So, but yeah, but the thing on the qualitative size, some degree quantitative size, it's not too different, the supermassive from the light hypermassive. I mean, you're a bit off in mass.
Well, there is a big difference, which is the existence of the black hole. I'm going to talk about that subject in the next problem that we are investigating. And the question is that if the black hole is really a necessary condition for the existence of a jet. I mean,
You're saying in the left side there is no black hole?
No, that's a neutron star. This is a supermassive neutron star.
Okay. So I thought it was something that was collapsing in a long time scales, but it's all...
No, yes, okay. Yes. Well, at the end, it's going to collapse, as you said, but this is a neutron star, and this evolution went up to 200 milliseconds. So, of course, one has to go much further, probably, but this is what we could do.
Thank you.
Okay. So the third problem has to do with the in spiral of binary neutron stars. Now, most of the binary neutron stars that are explored have been...
Was there a simulation, if I remember correctly, from Berkeley or something, saying the neutron star could also power a jet?
There is a big debate about that, and I can elaborate on this.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. There is a big debate, and different people and different groups define jets differently, and one has to have that also in mind. I can say more when we finish. Mm-hmm. So the in spiral of binary neutron stars. So most binary neutron stars in the studies that have been done until recently, like a couple of years ago, are irrotational, and for good reasons, because we don't believe that stars will have, at the point of merger, we are going to have a significant spin. But of course, we don't want to be biased against spinning systems and compromise a detection or maybe an interpretation. So we want to investigate what is the effect of the spin on binary systems. And the problem starts, of course, with the construction of initial data, which is by no means trivial. A first formulation self-consistent formulation has been presented some years ago by Wolfgang Tichy. And in our code, we have implemented his formulation, but we have also implemented a new formulation based on a new velocity decomposition. There are still extra problems that have to do with high spins and high compactions. The problem has been addressed by other groups by having spins less than 0.1, and they have found that spin effects are subdominant to diodal effects. And actually, they quantified that statement, and they said that the spin effects contribute to gravitational wave phase differences up to 5 radians, while tidal effects up to 20 radians. We have pumped up the spin a little bit, and we have reached spin of 0.32, and we have done simulations, longer simulations. Actually, this, as far as I remember, these are the longest spinning simulations of 14 orbits. And we have found, as you can see here, I'm plotting the difference between the spinning and the irrotational configuration, that the phase difference can go to 40 or 20 radians, which means that the spin, of course, can have an effect which is comparable or even larger than the tidal effect. Of course, again, this is a preliminary study, and there are a lot of caveats. For example, we haven't done a convergence analysis to see the robustness of our results. Of course, the time scale of this study was long, and we didn't have the resources to do that, but we plan to revisit this problem in the future. The fourth problem has to do with the great imposters, binary neutron stars posing as binary black holes. And it is funny that two days ago, this LIGO paper came out with a 2.6 compact object that they don't know if it is a black hole or if it is a neutron star. So this is these slides are essentially addressing this this issue. In order to have a high mass neutron star, you need a stiff equation of state. And of course, you want the sound speed to be less than the speed of light. So what you do is you use this P equal rho equation of state, where sigma equals one, and have the matching density at some multiple of the nuclear density. In our experiments, that in this problem that you will see, we used just the nuclear density for benchmark properties. So if you do that, for example, for in a regular equation of state, like the LF2 equation of state, it will take the blue curve to the red curve. So here I'm plotting the mass versus rest mass density and compactness versus rest mass density. So you can see that the mass increases like doubles. It goes from 2 to 4, and the compactness also increases significantly. So using our code, we have been able to construct a very compact binary system. Actually, the highest compactness, as I can remember, which was 0.34. For every Newton star, and corresponds to this cross that appears here on the TOV diagrams. And this is just slightly less than the maximum compactness which is imposed by causality. Now, we have put these stars on 80 kilometers because they are very heavy. 80 kilometers for a regular Newton star seems like a very big distance. You can have a lot of orbits, but for these heavy stars, in 80 kilometers, you have only like 2 orbits. And you can see that the profile here, the density profile along the x-axis, resembles very much of that of a quark star, since close to the surface, it has a very substantial and finite density, which is denoted by this red horizontal line. And then you have a sudden drop up to the neutron star surface where the density becomes zero. So we have evolved that system. And it merges in approximately two orbits. And as long as they touch, they immediately collapse to a black hole that settles into a Kerr black hole. And then we have done the same experiment with a binary black hole with the same masses. And we have compared the gravitational waves that are coming from the systems. So with the red curve here up, you can see on the up left panel, you can see the strain of the binary black hole, while with the blue and green, you can see the strain from the binary neutron star with two different resolutions. And on the right panel, you can see the phase again of these systems, and the phase difference between them is approximately 4 radians, which in principle is detectable by LIGO, but given the uncertainties on masses, spins, and so on, this is going to be very difficult. We have also compared the quasi-normal modes that are coming from the ring down, but we have found that within the accuracy of our simulations, we couldn't find any kind of difference. So the takeaway message is that the ring spiral in principle can be used for detection, but the ring down is almost indistinguishable with the curve spacetime.
So Antonius, regarding this accuracy of the simulations, so yeah, I mean, you're introducing a small length scale, right, which is this length scale over which the density takes this very sharp drop at the edge of the neutron star, right?
That's right.
So like sort of how many points are you resolving that length scale?
That's right. So as you can see, this sudden drop is approximately 500 meters. And the highest resolution that we used is 90 meters. This is the highest resolution that we could use with, you know, have some results in a half a year period. We couldn't do more than that. But yes, this is one of the problems of this kind of simulations that one has to be careful about.
So did you try to do like a convergence estimate of what the phase error and so forth is for the simulation?
Yes. Well, we have two runs, and we have done an elementary extrapolation, and this is what we get.
Related question: so, did you estimate the amount of ejecta that you may have?
There's zero ejecta. These stars, as long as they touch, they immediately disappear.
I see.
Yes. Absolutely zero ejecta and absolute zero disk.
So on the upper left curve. So, which curve should I be looking at to tell this full radiant phase difference?
On the upper right. So the difference between the red and the green or the blue.
Okay. So the upper left is the waveform, right? It seems it's on the.
No, really, I'm saying upper right.
But the on the left is the waveform. That's the waveform. Is that right?
That's right. That's the strain.
So it seems it is indeed like the last one or two cycles or so.
Yes. I mean, this is a very tight. This is for that. I mean, on one hand, we wanted to go as far away as possible in order to have more orbits, but that wasn't even easy on the initial level problem, because it's not easy to construct this kind of compact binaries, even with an initial data code.
Right. So I think in the data analysis perspective, it's not like you can, I mean, normally people just talk about phase errors or something like that, but you also need to determine what's the signal-to-noise ratio before and after that point.
We have that in the paper, but I don't remember the number.
Yeah, so if your signal-to-noise ratio at these last two cycles is too small, then you will not be able to tell, even if your phase error is full radiant.
In the paper, you can see the spectrum of this with the LIGO noise also, and you can see that they are on top of each other, and we are quoting also the signal to noise ratio, but right now I don't remember it.
Okay. So what's the total mass of this system again?
The total mass is let me see. It's 7.9 solar masses.
Okay, maybe the frequency is still low enough to lie in the LIGO band for this merger piece of the waveform.
The frequency is in the LIGO band, but if that can be distinguished, although I'm not an expert on that data analysis, it doesn't seem that it can be distinguished. So, and this is also, as I said, relative to, you know, the 2.6 object that they found in that paper. So, going back into the question that Louis was, I think, asking about the supermassive star and having a jet, we tried to investigate that issue. And of course, we know, so what I'm trying to say is that ergovisions we know that are associated with important astrophysical processes like the Pendle process or the Blanford-Snyder process, but there's no consensus if one needs a black hole or if it just needs an ergovision. And there are some preliminary simplistic calculations that say that just an ergovision will do, and you know, will do it, and maybe a jet can be launched without a horizon. So the question that we wanted to see a little bit more carefully is if we can have a jet from a compact object that has an ergovision but not a horizon. Of course, in order to answer that, you have to find a compact object that that has an ergovision and does not have a horizon. And well, these kind of objects have been found with causal equation of state, I have to remark, back in the 80s, from the Komatsu-Eriguchi-Hasichu group, where they found gamma equal 3 polytopes with causal neutron stars that are differentially rotating and exhibit ergovision. Here you can see the density normalized to the maximum density with red and yellow, and the torus inside is the ergovision. With the green color. But unfortunately, when you evolve the stars, and actually we have repeated their calculations and we have found some even more promising models, and this is one of the more promising models. I can explain what I mean later by that. When you evolve them, in a couple of dynamical times, they collapse. These are some snapshots of that collapse. Fortunately, with the new equation of state that we were playing around in the previous problem, the impostor case, we were able to construct again ergostars that stay for many dynamical times, more than 150 dynamical times. And I can play here a small video to see and appreciate the stationarity of these models. Again, with yellow and red is the rest mass density. As you can see, these are pretty much quite homogeneous stars. The density drops very quickly close to the surface. And there is the ergovision that it is inside with the toroidal geometry, which is with a green color here. So we have constructed various models and tried to investigate how stable they are. And as far as we could see from our simulations, they were stable for many dynamical times, as you can appreciate. In order to be a little bit more quantitative, we have measured the mode growth of the M equal 1 and M equal 2. And we can see that there is a mode growth, but nothing extraordinary. Similar plots for the gamma equal 3 polytopes, also they don't show any kind of growth, but these stars essentially do a quasi-radial collapse. And then we also plot the on the right panel the kinetic energy over the gravitational potential energy, which is a normal diagnostic for a Baumov instability, and we see this small increase, but nothing significant. We have investigated the full parameter space by using other equations of state and also by moving the matching density inside the core like twice the nuclear density, as you can see in the bottom middle panel. With black curve are the TOV solutions, and with a red solid curve is the uniformly mass shedding limit. So the ergo stars are the green points, all the green points. Which, as you can see, most of them are differentially rotating. The blue dashed line is connecting the extrema of the J equal constant curves. This is the turning point line where the Friedmann-Ipser Sorkin theorem relies and says that all models on the left are secularly unstable while on the right are stable. And this curve, because it's very close with the dynamical instability, is also a criterion pretty much for the dynamical instability of those models. On the right, I'm plotting the polar over the equatorial radius and again the T over W, and with red dots you can see all the models that are on the right of the turning point, and with blue dots all the models that are on the left on the turning point. So clearly there are some promising models that can be dynamically stable, like the one that I have just showed. And so now we have to go back into the original question that I was talking about. And
Antonio, sorry to interrupt.
Yep.
But so just going back to the slide. So you were saying that there is some slower growth in these modes that you see in these plots for quote dynamically stable ergo stars. So are you saying that you think there is some instability that's taking place over this, like, you know, 10 or 30 PC, or just that it's the accumulation of truncation error, or you don't know, or
I have to be honest with you. The plots that I'm plotting here are referring to this star here. They have this matching density exactly at nuclear density, where the steep profile of the density goes to zero. So the accuracy of the simulation will play definitely a big role. So one has to do a more complete study of these ergostars, where this matching density is closer to the core and not so much to the surface. So because having such a high density in the surface, you have to resolve this little region that you asked before, and all these issues about the accuracy. So to make the long story short, clearly there is no dynamical instability here. If there is a secular instability, and maybe there is some kind of problem with the accuracy of this models because of this kind of reason. So the bottom line is that what kind of instability are you talking? Are you talking about the secular instability? Are you talking about the dynamical instability? What kind of instability are you talking about? Of course, there is the famous Friedman ergosphere instability, but this is on time scales that are humongous, like 10 to the 5 m. So we are not interested about those kind of instabilities.
Maybe you could say what you mean exactly by the difference between the two. I mean, I thought you were just sort of, by dynamical instability, just meant on timescales of order.
On dynamical timescales. As you can see here, for example, this ergostar has been evolved for 40 periods, which is like 400 dynamical timescales. So clearly this is dynamically stable.
Sure. I mean, it seems a little bit qualitative whether you're just, it's a factor of 10 PC or more, but yes, I guess just wondering if you thought that growth was like a real feature or you weren't sure or not.
Yes. The growth is on the borders of numerical error, I think. Because of the density profiles. So definitely it's not significant. I mean, we have seen, we have evolved a lot of rotating stars, and we have seen what kind of exponential growth you get very quickly. Definitely it's not like that. Of course, this does not mean that there is a more slow instability that it is building on. So that's the most honest thing I can say.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah. So you said this is a differentially rotating star?
Yes, yes.
Is it possible to still have the ergosphere while you don't have differential rotation?
No. As you can see, as you can see in this plot here on the bottom panel here, there are a little bit of models here. I don't know if you can see my cursor. Some green points below the red solid curve. These points are uniformly rotating. So there is a possibility that there are models with algorithms with uniform rodent, and actually we have identified them in this paper, but all of them lie on the right of the turning point theorem. So we think that all of them, they are dynamically unstable.
So two questions, one minor, the other one maybe more, have more substance. So how do you find the dynamical time? You just answered that this was about like 400 dynamical times, but I was thinking dynamical time was given by the period of your inner edge. So what's your dynamical time? And the second question, the more relevant one is, so this, you're evolving with what? An ideal MHC code? And if so...
This is just pure hydro. These are all, until now, it's pure hydro.
Pure hydro?
Yes.
Right, but now you're showing magnetic fields.
This is a new project.
Okay.
I haven't
started. Yes,
I haven't gone to this transparency yet. And actually, this is what I want to say: just that this is a work in progress, and we are in the middle of this work, and that's about it.
All right. So then, how do you define the time scale? The dynamical time scale?
We have you can define it either with the central density or with the some kind of compactness. These diagnostics differ by factors of two or three.
Okay.
And the PC here is the central period, so it's by the angular velocity at the center of the star.
Okay, perfect. And then going back to this project. So now, okay, you're putting magnetic fields and Your code, I guess, is ideal MHD?
That's right.
And how much, what's the beta parameter you're able to afford here?
So the magnetic fields that we have here are 10 to 16.
I see.
10 to 16. And so they are not, they're not so small. Of course, if what we have seen that if you go like to 10 to the 17 magnetic fields, the star collapses quickly you get a black hole very quickly. But if the magnetic field is not significantly less, as I said, this is a 4 times 10 to 16, then the ergo star and the ergo region remains for a longer period of time.
You're saying the star collapses much quickly because you are transforming angular momentum and then you deplete the differential support. Is that okay?
Yeah. The extreme magnetic field is working very efficiently on that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we're all thinking.
Oh, okay. Probably this is going to be a topic of, as I said, this is a work in progress, and so we are just trying to answer the initial question that I was trying to pose, but there was too much work to be done until we reached this point, so that's the whole...
You mentioned this need, or I would question that need, but let's say if we're thinking of a rotating object, as you said, some people have said, oh, you need the ergosphere, some are, oh, you need the horizon, some are, oh, no, but it's a combination of both. You need a current sheet as well.
Yeah.
So how are you going to, are you going to go after that question with this project? I mean, are you going to try?
Well, depends, of course, on the output or on the outcome of this project and how promising it looks like. If the results seem that we judge that the ergo region is not, so strong and is destroyed easily, and the star loses its stability, and so on, then I don't think the continuation of this project will make too much, But we have to think about it. I mean, this is a work in progress.
Okay, thank you.
As a final project, and I don't know if I have time, but this is. Some new results that we have achieved last year is we, for the first time, we have solved the full set of Einstein equations with the ideal MHD for a rotating star. So this is, we are not imposing here any magnetic field or anything like that. So this is a self-consistent calculation. You see a normal star and a supermassive star with both toroidal and toroidal magnetic fields. On the bottom line, you can see the surface of the star and contours of the conformal factor with green, or the non-conformal flat of the conformal geometry with red and blue. And just to wrap things up, there is an interesting thing that we found is that you can see, for example, in the bottom right plot, I'm plotting the pressure versus density along the x-axis, which is normalized by the radius of the star. So one corresponds to the surface of the star. So what we have found is that the pressure becomes zero inside the star. And this point here corresponds to the point where the toroidal magnetic field has its maximum. You can see a little bit on the top left, the contours here of the density as they create a bump around the toroidal magnetic field. So in a sense, this is like an electro vacuum region, like a solenoid inside the neutron star with no matter and extreme magnetic field, which makes it really amazing. Of course, this is again a preliminary study. We need to explore these solutions and more importantly, evolve them and see how stable they are and so on and so on. So this is definitely regarding the question that Louis said, something that we plan to investigate in the future and spend some time on this. So thank you. And yeah, I'm happy to answer any more questions.
So thank you very much, Antonius. Thanks for answering all the questions. So do people have any more? Just go ahead and raise your hand. Go ahead, Luis.
Yes, I was wondering if you were aware. So there was this paper by Carlos Valenzuela, I think Carlos Pona and a few others, where they were trying to go after this question of what is it that you need and how important the ergosphere is. In their case, they did, there's something with some approximation, right? So they would produce these stars that were kind of fake, but then they would take the star out and just keep the space-time that had an ergosphere.
You're talking about this this reference here, I think. Where is that? No, this is on the short camera. Who is
that? Yeah, that's that. Yeah, that may be the one. You're right. So do you see any potential, tension if you then do it with your ideal MHD and you don't find anything? While the force free shows.
The main difference between what we are doing and this work is that, as you have seen, we have spent a lot of time trying to identify a stable, a stable neutron star that has an ergo region. When you fix the, as they were doing, when you fix the gravity sector and, nothing changes, then things are pretty simple. But the whole question is what happens with the ergo region, and this is also related to the short gamma ray burst and the question that you asked here with this star here, that this rotating star that remains, if the magnetic field is acting so hardly on the ergo region and maybe on the differential rotation and all these kind of things, then it will create a big difference with the black hole. So to be honest, I think that the results here are simplistic. The results of that paper that you mentioned are simplistic because of the Cowling approximation, essentially.
Sure. So what I was thinking is if maybe at some point, if you do see the star hanging around for whatever sufficiently long time, to then try and answer where the things, if things turn out to be different with the ideal MHD and the force free, to perhaps maybe there is a collaboration possible with them for them to solve it with the recessive MHD code and then use your data.
Definitely. I'm very happy for that kind of collaboration. Yes.
So in that paper, do they see a JET or not?
According to what we call a JET, they haven't investigated very seriously that. That phenomenon. They definitely see a collimation. They definitely see some similar currents and some similar electromagnetic energy. But I think it was a too simplistic calculation relative to the, you know, the level of the discussion that nowadays we have.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, maybe just a comment about that paper. So, I mean, like, if you just look at, like, black hole force-free solutions, you know, that have, like, the Blandford-Zanuck type thing, at sort of high spins, if you trace back where the energy is coming from, you know, some of the field lines will hit the black hole horizon, and the energy is coming from the horizon, basically. But some of the field lines, if you allow current sheets, will actually hit the current sheet in the ergo region. And so there, it's actually, you know, coming from a dissipation of, you know, quote unquote, negative energy at the current sheet. And so then if you have an ergo star that you have force free and you allow, you know, dissipation at the current sheet, then you won't have the horizon piece, but you'll have the same current sheet dissipation of negative energy at the current sheet. And so I think that's what they were seeing in that paper. And so but in order to get sort of happen to the rotational energy just from the space time, you need some sort of non-ideal part. You need some sort of dissipation, and so the current sheet provides that, or like having resistive MHD formation would provide that.
Yes, and also I want to add, I agree with what William said. I want to add again the same problem that the black hole is not destroyed. It's staying there forever. You cannot do anything with it. So you will have forever both the horizon, the ergo region, and so on and so on. But for the neutron star, this is not by default. And in the process, the neutron star may be destroyed or change shape or, you know, so I think that's also a crucial parameter between the comparison between the neutron star and the black hole case.
Okay. Well, if there are no more questions, thanks again, Antonis, for that nice talk. And
thank you for the invitation in the middle of all this craziness.
Yeah. Thanks for talking to us.
Yep. Thank you.